infection. "How'd you get that?" I ask Heidi, grimacing at the thought of that burning sensation every time the baby peed, of the catheter shooting up the urethra into her tiny bladder. "Poor hygiene," she says simply. And I'm reminded of the baby sitting in that shitty diaper for God knows how long. The bacteria in the feces climbing back up into the bladder and kidneys. Festering. The baby's on antibiotics now. Her mother under doctor's orders to wipe from front to back. The very thing Heidi badgered me about when Zoe was still in diapers. I imagine Willow sitting on the sofa now, staring at the TV in a daze, as she's prone to do. She's not 18, I remind myself, picturing some kid that still needs to be reminded to wash her hands, to eat her vegetables, to make her bed, to wipe her baby's rump from front to back. I'm still waiting to hear back from Martin Miller, PI. I'm thinking long and hard of ways to hurry this along, some kind of information I can give him, though my own internet searches have hit a dead end. I considered a picture, but highly doubt Willow Greer would let me snap a photo of her, or that Heidi would give me the A-OK. I consider that old suitcase, brown and worn, the one she tucks beneath the sofa bed when she isn't in the room, as if we might forget it's there. I thought about snooping inside to see if I could find something, some kind of clue, a driver's license or state ID, a cell phone with a contact number. And then Martin suggested fingerprints, suggested snagging some glass or the remote control, something she touched that would validate an identity she couldn't fake. He walked me through it, how to preserve Willow Greer's fingerprints so he could send them to his lab. But all that will have to wait until after my trip. I have yet to receive a tweet from W. Greer, which leads me to believe she's dead. That she did it, like she said she would. That she ended her life. Or maybe she's lying low in some Chicago condo, wanting the world to believe she's dead. How the hell would I know? But still, I check every day, just in case. She was interested in her birthmark, Heidi tells me then, interrupting my thoughts. Who was?
The doctor.
The baby's birthmark? I ask, remembering the one that stared at me from the back of the baby's leg when Heidi removed our blue towel from her buttocks and wiped her clean.
Yeah, she says. Says it's called a port wine stain.
And I imagine a glass of Merlot spilled across the back of that leg. Heidi says something about vascular birthmarks and capillaries expanding and the dilated blood vessels beneath the baby's skin. And that's when she says to me that, according to the doctor, we might want to have them removed, with laser treatment. She says it as if this is something we really might want to consider having done. We, she and me, as if it's our baby we're discussing. I imagine my wife, talking into the phone with her spaghetti hair and haggard eyes, stating with this blank expression on her face,
the doctor said they can be embarrassing for kids as they get older. That they're easier to treat in infancy because the blood vessels are smaller.
I'm speechless. I can't respond. I open my mouth and close it again. And then, for lack of anything better to say, I ask, how's Zoe? And Heidi says,
fine.
I never say a thing about the birthmark. As the conversation drifts from birthmarks to the weather, I realize how exhausted Heidi sounds, pulled to the limit. Like a stretchy toy that's been yanked too far and won't go back to its original shape. I almost feel sorry. Almost. But then my mind drifts back to Heidi and me in our pre-baby days. Before Zoe. Before the abortion that rattled Heidi's world much more than she cared to admit. When we would take the steps, two at a time, to the rooftop deck of the apartment where we lived at the time. To watch the fireworks erupt from Navy Pier every Saturday night. I think of the way we sat together, on the same lounge chair, drinking from the same bottle of beer, staring at the city's skyline. The John Hancock Building. The Sears Tower, long before it had been renamed. We had so many aspirations back then. To travel the world and to see things. The Great Wall of China. The Blue Caves of Greece. To compete in a triathlon together. Plans that fell by the wayside as soon as we had a kid.
I never wanted to be one of those couples, one of those couples so consumed with their individual ambitions and their kids that the marriage got kicked to the curb, ignored and neglected by seemingly more important aspects of life. What I wanted in our marriage was for us to be a team, Heidi and me. But these days it feels as if we're nothing but opponents, opponents playing for rival teams. I start to feel bad for her in this mess with that girl and the baby, all alone. And yet, I think, considering the haggard eyes and the spaghetti hair, this is her doing. But still, I can't get that note out of my mind, the one in the briefcase with the single word, yes. I pulled it out at the airport, on the plane. I pulled it out once we'd checked into our hotel, a luxury hotel in the heart of New York City. I pulled it out again after Cassidy, Tom, Henry, and I had parted ways at the check-in desk, and Cassidy had said, toodaloo, with a one-finger wave. I sat on the crisp white bed in my stately room, staring at the view out the window, a bird's-eye view of the building next door, not 10 feet away, nothing but brick and windows, and pulled that note out and held it in my hand. I found myself appraising everything about that note. Where she got the purple sticky note, the jaggedness of the letters. Was she nervous when she wrote it, short on time, jarred by the baby? Or did her handwriting just suck more than mine? I wonder when she wrote the note. 10 o'clock, right after we'd gone to bed and she heard, through the cracks of the door, Zoe's breathing morph into a snore. Or sometime in the middle of the night, forced to my briefcase by sleeplessness, by plaguing memories of being hurt by someone that kept her tossing and turning all night long. Or maybe it was early in the morning, awakened by the sound of my alarm clock, when she tiptoed to the briefcase by the front door as I turned on the shower and stepped inside. Who knew? And now, a day later, my meeting's done for the day, a rendezvous with Tom, Henry, and Cassidy planned in the hotel's bar in some 20 minutes, I debate telling Heidi about the note. But what good would it do? It would throw Heidi into a nosedive. That's what it would do. Having proof that the girl was abused, or at least a claim of abuse, would be enough for Heidi to suggest we keep her. Forever. Like those damn kittens.
They're staying.
There's a knock at the door. I barely register the sound before Heidi, over the phone, snaps,
"Who's that?"
And I lie, claiming, "Room service." Because I refuse to admit that Cassidy offered to stop by and proofread the offering memorandum, the company profile and financials for some asset we're trying to sell, before we all head down to the hotel bar for a nightcap. I move from the bed into the door, telling Heidi how I ordered room service, how I was staying in for the night to finish up the offering memorandum which I was supposed to finish last weekend, how I ordered a turkey club sandwich and cheesecake, and how I might tune in for the end of the Cubs game, if I finish the offering memorandum in time. I slide the door open and find, as expected, Cassidy on the other side. Bright red lipstick delineating her lips so that I can think of nothing but those lips. I raise a finger to my mouth and silently whisper, "Shh," and then louder so Heidi can hear, "Did you bring any ketchup?" And watch as Cassidy stifles a laugh. I'm going straight to hell, I think, as I thank the bogus room service attendant and slam the door closed, grateful when Heidi says she'll let me go so my food doesn't grow cold. "Love you," I say, and she says,
"Me too."
I toss my phone under the bed. I watch Cassidy move across the room with gall, as if this is her room. There's no hesitation about it, no hovering in the doorway waiting to be invited in. Not with Cassidy. She's changed her clothes. Only Cassidy would change from a dress into a dress for a nightcap, replacing the formal black suit with a Grecian-style dress, fitted and sleeveless, the color of rust. She sits on a low yellow armchair, slinging one long leg across the other, asking first about the offering memorandum, and then about Heidi. "She's good," I say, pulling up the offering memorandum on my laptop and handing it to Cassidy, careful not to touch as the computer passes between hands. "Yep, she's good."
And then I excuse myself before I say it a third time, forcing my eyes to stay on her eyes, and not on her legs or her lips, or her breasts in the rust-colored dress. Not big, but not small either. The kind that work well on Cassidy's lissome frame. Too much extra baggage would throw the whole thing off. She'd be disproportionate, I think, as I stand, staring at the display of hotel freebies on the bathroom's black sink. Shampoo, conditioner, lotion, soap. As I rip open the soap and wash my face, splashing cold water on the skin so that I'll stop thinking about Cassidy's knockers. Or her long legs. Or the lips. Red lips. The color of cayenne pepper. She calls to me from the adjoining room, and I step from the bathroom, patting my face dry with a towel. I slide into my own low yellow armchair beside hers, and pull it up to the round table. We go over the offering memorandum. I focus on words like shares and stocks and per unit, and not the manicured hands that work their way across the computer screen, or the skirt of the rust-colored dress hovering mere millimeters from my leg. We head downstairs when we finish, standing side by side on the elevator. Cassidy leans close to me to mock a man riding downstairs with us, a man with a bad toupee, as she elongates her neck and laughs out loud, her fingernails grazing the skin on my forearm. I wonder what others think of us, me with a wedding band, her without. Do they see us as colleagues in New York on a business trip? Or something more than that? Me, the adulterer, and her, the mistress. In the hotel's bar, I snag the steel side chair so that Cassidy's forced onto a low sofa with Tom and Henry. We drink. Too much. We talk. Gossip. Make fun of co-workers and clients, which is far too easy to do. Satirize spouses, and then claim to be kidding when someone's wife becomes the butt of a joke. Heidi. Cassidy sips from a Manhattan, leaving ruby-red lip marks along the edges of the cocktail glass, and says, "See, this, gentlemen, is the reason I'll never get married." And I wonder which it is. That she refuses to be the butt of some joke, or refuses to mock the one she vowed to love in good times and in bad, sickness and health, so long as they both shall live. Or maybe it's the whole monogamy thing that dissuades her. And then later in the John, a completely sauced Henry accosts me with a condom. "In case you need this later," he says. And he laughs a haughty laugh with that lewd sense of humor that is Henry Tomlin. "I hardly think Heidi and I need birth control," I say. But I take it anyway and slide it into my pants pocket, not wanting to be crass and leave it on the bathroom sink. Henry leans in close, reeking of good old Jack Daniel's Tennessee whiskey, a throwback to his redneck days, and whispers, "I wasn't talking about Heidi," and gives me a wink. We lose track of time. Tom orders another round on him, some type of pilsner for Tom and me, more Jack Daniels for Henry, an Alabama slammer for Cassidy. She pulls the fruit out, an orange and maraschino cherry, and eats that first. The bartender announces, "Last call!" I forget about my phone completely, the one tossed onto the bed, hidden beneath the folds of the white bedspread.
Heidi. Zoe goes to bed early, riddled with a headache and stuffy nose, the return of spring allergy season or maybe just a cold. It's impossible to tell, as it is nearly always the case this time of year, when tree pollens are at their height, but cold and flu season has yet to recede from view. So I dole out both pain relievers and antihistamines. And Zoe falls into bed, drifting immediately into a drug-induced sleep, as I kiss her forehead gingerly, leaving the TV on in Chris's and my bedroom, as the sound of some reality TV show permeates the walls. Willow and I sit, perched in the living room. She reading silently from Anne of Green Gables, and me on my laptop, feigning work, though it's the furthest thing from my mind. It's been 3 days since I've been into the office. 3 days since anything work-related has crossed my mind. My absence has been felt at work. A happy bouquet of roses and lilies now taking up residence on my kitchen table, with a Get Well Soon card. Each morning I prepare my most macabre voice and put in a call to Dana, receptionist extraordinaire, and say that I'm unwell, the flu, I believe, and blame my own foolishness for not getting the vaccine. My temperature hovers somewhere around 102, depending on the day, and my body aches through and through, everything from the hairs on my head to the tips of my toes. I've wrapped myself in blankets and layer upon layer of clothes, and yet I'm overwhelmed by chills, never warm, praying that Zoe doesn't get sick, though, being the good mother I am. Zoe, of course, had her vaccine. But still, I say, before breaking into a coughing fit that sounds really quite sincere, silently giving myself kudos for thespian abilities of which I was unaware I possessed. The compression of air in my lungs, the mucilant secretions that erupt from my chest like hot lava from Mauna Loa, you never know. None of it, of course, is true. I'm finding myself to be quite skilled in the art of lying. I gaze eagerly at the baby, sound asleep on the floor, waiting impatiently for the first hint of movement. The fluttering of eyelids, the flicker of a hand, which will eject me from my chair and to her side a split second before Willow. Like children in a competitive game of slapjack, both driven to be the first to spot the jack and whack it with their hand. I type meaningless words into the computer screen, evidence that I am working. My eyes move from Ruby to Willow to the laptop and back again, a never-ending circuit that makes me giddy, afflicted with a sudden sensation of vertigo. I listen as from the adjoining wall, the laughter of Graham and his latest lady love drift through the drywall to greet me. The tone of her voice, flirty and insincere, indicative of a brief dalliance and nothing more. Graham's specialty. I watch as Willow's eyes rise up from the book to listen. To listen to the kittenish laughter and the shrill tone of voice. And as they intersect mine, as those icy blue eyes cut through my own jittery orbs, I find myself looking away quickly, considering the ochre bruise, and wondering what it would take for someone like Willow to snap. How much maltreatment and exploitation could someone handle before losing self-control? I cannot look at her, into those eyes that threaten me. I stare at the white walls instead, a framed photo collage of Chris and Zoe and me, black and white photographs in wooden frames, the cat in theirs. The word family carved from fiberboard, hand-painted and hung in the middle of the display. I pat at the pocket of my purple robe and feel for the Swiss Army knife inside. A precaution. I heed Chris's warning. How much can you really know about another person? And then the baby does start to stir. Her eyelids flutter and there's a flicker of the hand. But it's Willow, not me, with her lightning-fast reflexes, who reaches the baby first, and lifts her from the floor in that rickety way that she does, her arms shaky, her grasp insecure so that for a fraction of a second or more, I'm certain Ruby will fall. I feel myself rise and step forward to catch the plummeting child, but then Willow's eyes stop me in my tracks, staring at me, smug. Taking great delight in my distress. Ha! Those eyes mock me, and I beat you. As if she knew all along that I was waiting. Waiting ever so patiently to hold the baby. To hold that beautiful baby in my arms when she awoke from sleep. I lift a hand to my mouth to stifle a scream that threatens to emerge from somewhere deep within. Are you okay? She asks me, as she returns to the chair, bundling Ruby in the pink blanket. And then, when I don't respond fast enough, she asks again, Ma'am? My hand drops from my gaping mouth to my splintered heart, and I lie, yes, just fine. Finding that lying is so easy to do, as an air of serenity disguises my turbulent state. The tempestuous clouds that roll in before a storm. I'm suddenly aware of the TV in the bedroom, blaringly loud. The reality show is broken for commercial, and suddenly we are being screamed at, chided, and admonished to buy some sort of fabric softener which smells of eucalyptus leaves. It enrages me. The sound of it, loud and emphatic, might wake Zoe from sleep. I curse it out loud, that damned commercial. I curse the TV and the network and the eucalyptus fabric softener, which I will never buy. I march down the hall to turn the TV off, pressing power so vehemently that the TV slides 2 inches or more on the console, scratching the wall. Behind me, in the queen-size bed, beneath the matelasse cover, Zoe rolls over onto a side, her hands still clutching the remote control, though she sleeps. She lets out a sleepy sigh. My heart drums loudly in my chest, overwhelmed by that sense of being completely out of control, powerless, on the verge of going mad. As I stand there in the bedroom, staring at the blank TV screen, I feel overcome by a sudden wave of nausea. My legs turn to jelly, and for one split second, I'm certain I've gone into cardiac arrest. I inch into the bathroom as blackness sweeps across my eyes like window cleaner splashed on a dirty pane. I drop onto the edge of the bathtub and set my head beneath my legs, forcing the blood back up to my brain. And then I reach for the faucet and turn the water on, so that Zoe, if she awakes from her anesthetized doze, will not hear me cry. And that's when I see it. The filigree bird painted a distressed red. The shabby chic hook on the wall. An extra hole, poorly plastered and painted. A reminder that when Chris hung the hook, he hung it askew. I purchased the hook from a flea market in Kane County, on a trip Jennifer and I made some 6, maybe 7 years ago. The 40-some miles out of the city into St. Charles was the closest either of us had been to a vacation in years. As Jennifer and I scoured through antiques and collectibles for things we didn't need, the girls, Zoe and Taylor, rode behind in a red wagon, stuffing themselves with hot dogs and popcorn to stay quiet and satisfied. The hook, completely bare. I grope at my neck, but come up empty, as I knew with certainty I would do, for I recall hanging the chain, the golden chain with my father's wedding band, the words, "The beginning of forever," engraved along its inside, from the filigree bird before I kissed Zoe on the forehead goodnight. Before I left the bedroom, dimming the lights, and returned to the kitchen to clean pots and pans that awaited me on the cooling stove. Before I gathered the foul-smelling plastic bag from the garbage can and marched it down the hall to the chute. Before I settled down with my laptop to type meaningless words onto the screen, waiting fruitlessly for Ruby to stir. She has taken my father's wedding ring. All at once, it's as if he's died again, my father. I'm teleported to the morning my mother phoned from their Cleveland home. He'd been sick for months, and so it should have come as no surprise to me, the fact that he was dead. And yet, the news of it, the very words slipping from my mother's tongue, her tone newsy rather than sorrowful, "He's dead," completely bowled me over, left me stupefied. For weeks, I went on believing it was a mistake, a misunderstanding. Certainly this couldn't be true. There was the funeral and the burial, of course, and I watched as some man resembling my father, but cold and rubbery, his features pliable and strange, was lowered into the ground, And then, like the dutiful daughter I was, I tossed my roses on top of the casket because that was what my mother carried when they were wed. Lavender roses. Though I believed in my heart of hearts, it wasn't my father inside that box. I tried phoning him each and every day, my father, worried when he didn't answer his cell phone. From time to time, my mother would answer, and in her kindest, gentlest voice, she'd say, "Heidi, dear, you can't keep calling like this." And when I continued to call, she suggested to me, to Chris, that I see someone. Someone who could help me sort through my grief. But I refused. As I refused to see someone, a counselor, a shrink, as the OBGYN suggested I do after he killed Juliet. After he appropriated my womb. It's nearing 10 o'clock in New York City. I call Chris from a cell phone stashed in my pocket to tell him that Willow has stolen from me. And yet his cell phone rings and rings without an answer. I wait 10 minutes and then try again, knowing that Chris is a night owl, and so he is certainly awake, certainly slaving away on some offering memorandum that he swore he'd be writing. Or so he said. When again there is no response, I text a message, "Call me, ASAP," and proceed to wait futilely for 20 minutes or more. And then I begin to seethe. I search online for a phone number for the Manhattan Hotel and put in a call, asking reception to transfer me to Chris Wood's room. I whisper for Zoe's sake. And she asks me more than once to repeat myself. There's a pause as the woman tries to make the connection, but then she comes back on the line and says apologetically, "There's no answer in that room, ma'am. Would you like to leave a message?" I hang up the phone. I consider calling again and asking to be transferred to Cassidy Knudsen's room. I consider a red-eye flight out to New York. A surprise appearance in the lobby of his hotel, desperate to catch him and Cassidy flitting about, laughing at some joke the rest of the world is not privy to. I see Cassidy in her hotel-issued robe, Chris in his, champagne delivered via room service and strawberries. Yes, of course, strawberries. The do-not-disturb door hanger placed on the handle. I can feel the blood creeping up my neck. Making my ears ring, my pulse loud enough that Zoe, sound asleep, can certainly hear. My heartbeat is so erratic it makes me dizzy, and I drop my head again beneath my legs to catch my breath, thinking evil thoughts toward my husband and that woman. Thoughts of planes bound for Denver bursting into flames and crashing to the ground. "It's time for Ruby's medicine," I hear then, the timid voice of that girl, that kleptomaniac who has stolen my father's wedding band from me. I want to scream, and yet, instead, with astounding control, I say, "You took my father's wedding ring. You took the ring." And I want to grab her by the neck and shake the living daylights out of her, because she took the one thing in the world that meant the most to me. But I remain on the edge of the bathtub, running my hand along the fleece robe, along the straight edge of the Swiss Army knife tucked safely inside, considering its many tools, or weapons, if you may. A corkscrew, scissors, a gimlet, and of course, a blade. "What?" she asks feebly. Hurt, as if she's the one who's been laid to waste, pillaged, plundered. Her voice is light, barely audible, as she shakes her head desperately, frantically, and whispers, "No." But her eyes don't look at mine, and she's begun to fidget with her hands. She blinks rapidly, her fair skin turning red. Telltale signs of deceit. I rise to my feet, and as I do, she retreats backward, quickly, and out of the room, prattling in an undertone something or other about Jesus and forgiveness and mercy. A confession. "Where is it?" I ask, following her into the living room, my footsteps delicate but fast, a half step faster than her own, so that I quickly narrow the gap. I drift across the room in my sheepskin slippers and turn her by the arm so that she's forced to look at me, forced to maintain eye contact as only the best perjurer can. She steps away quickly. I've intruded upon her space. She sets her arms behind herself so that I cannot touch them again. "Where is my father's wedding band?" I demand this time, aware of the way the baby watches us from the floor, gnawing on a polka dot sock she's pulled from a foot, her pale pink piggies hovering midair, completely insouciant to the tension surrounding her, filling the room, making it hard to breathe. "I don't have it," Willow lies, her voice as spineless as an earthworm or a leech. "I promise, ma'am, I don't have the ring," she says, but her eyes remain shifty, scheming. And in place of an impressionable, naive young woman, as I had once perceived her to be, I see someone instead who's wily and astute, artful and sly. She evades my stare, twitches uncomfortably in her own skin, as if it's suddenly the skin of a porcupine, riddled with quills. An act. Her words come out staccato-like, abrupt and clipped, an outpouring of denials. "I didn't do it," and "I swear." Her hands over-gesticulating, her face turning red. A charade. She mocks me with her lies and her tomfoolery, with the naive eyes that are anything but naive. She knew exactly what she was doing. From that very first day, I spotted her at the Fullerton station waiting in the rain, waiting for someone like me to take the bait. "What did you do with it?" I ask frantically. "What did you do with the ring?"
"I don't have it," she says again. "I don't have the ring,"
shaking her head briskly from side to side, the bob of a pendulum. "But I insist. You do. You took it from the bathroom hook. You took my father's ring."
"Ma'am,"
she pleads, and it's pathetic almost, the tone of her voice. Heartbreaking, really, if it wasn't such a sham. She retreats a step and I follow, quickly. The abruptness of the movement, of my movement, a single step but no more, making her flinch, a wince escaping from somewhere deep within. My hand gropes for the Swiss Army knife in the pocket of the purple robe, clutching tightly as I utter the simple word, "Go." I feel it tremble in my hand, that knife. And I think to myself, "Don't make me." She's shaking her head, swiftly, from side to side, the sepia hair falling into her bulging eyes, her lips parting to mouth a single word,
"No."
And then she's begging me to let her stay, begging me not to make her go. Outside, it's begun to rain again, raindrops tap, tap, tapping at the bay window, though it's a drizzle and not quite a storm, not yet at least. Though there's no telling what the night will bring. "Go," I say again, "go now, before I call the police." And I take a step for the phone sitting on the kitchen countertop.
"Please don't,"
she begs, and then,
"Please don't make me go."
And she's staring out the window at the rain. "You took the ring," I insist. "Give me the ring."
"Please, ma'am,"
she says, and then,
"Heidi,"
as if trying to reach me on a more personal level. And yet it strikes me as inappropriate, presumptuous even. The audacity of it reminds me of her impudence, her overconfidence. The rest is just a pretense, a work of fiction, a pathetic display used to slink into my home and steal from me. I wonder what else she took. The Polish pottery, my grandmother's pearls, Chris's class ring. Mrs. Wood, I state.
I don't have the ring, Mrs. Wood. I swear to you, I don't have the ring.
Then you sold it, I maintain. Where did you sell it, Willow? The pawn shop? There's one in Lincoln Park. I picture it clear as day, a storefront on Clark with the sign, We Buy Gold. I think of myself that afternoon, lying down for a brief nap. Did she pawn the ring while I was asleep? But no, I hung the chain on the hook tonight, before I kissed Zoe goodnight and dimmed the lights, cleaned the kitchen, and settled down with my laptop to work. Or not work. To pretend to work. Or maybe that was last night, I think. Feeling suddenly lost and confused, not knowing which day it is, or which way is up. But knowing with certainty that she took the ring. How much did you get for it? I ask then, all of a sudden. And when she doesn't respond, I ask it again. How much did you get for my father's wedding ring? Wondering, 500? 1,000? All the while stroking the smooth edge of the Swiss Army knife with my hand, running my thumb along the blade until it most certainly bleeds. I don't feel it, the blood, but I visualize it. A drop. Maybe two, that seeps onto the purple robe. And then she's gathering her things from around the home. Baby bottles and formula. She's collecting the torn jeans and leather lace-up boots, the army green coat, the vintage suitcase from the office down the hall, and dragging them to the front door, where she drops them in a heap, turning to me sullenly, the phony despair replaced with a stoic expression in her eyes. But when she moves to lift the baby from the floor, I intercede. Over my dead body is what I'm thinking. But what I say is, you can't take care of her. You know that as well as I do. She would have died from that infection if it wasn't for me. An untreated urinary tract infection could lead to sepsis. Without treatment, a person could die. But those weren't my words. Those came from the doctor at the clinic, didn't they? It was the doctor who told us that, wanting to know how long this had been going on, the baby's persistent irritability and that untamed fever.
A week, maybe two,
Willow had said regretfully. But I'd mocked her candor and said, Just a few days, dear, not a week. Knowing what the doctor would think of us if we had let the infection go on for weeks, had allowed the fever to carry on that long. I'd rolled my eyes at the doctor then, there in the tawdry office, and said of Willow, She has such a poor sense of time, teenagers, you know. One day, one week, it makes no difference to them. And the doctor, perhaps the mother of a teen or a preteen herself, had nodded her head and agreed. The lying, these days, it's just so easy a thing to do. It comes naturally, automatically, until I can no longer tell what's fact, what's fiction. You take that baby, I say, and I'll be forced to call the police. Child endangerment in addition to theft. She's safer here with me. She needs to understand that the baby is better off with me. When I met you, I remind her, she had a fever, blisters on her rear end, patches of eczema across her skin. She hadn't been bathed in weeks, and you were all but out of food. It's a wonder she wasn't hypothermic, emaciated, or dead. Besides, I tack on, inching closer to the baby, knowing good and well I will fight for her if I need to, that I will draw the knife from the robe and argue self-defense. But I can see already, by the resignation in her eyes, that I will not need to fight. The baby for her is a burden, a weight. The visceral feelings, that undeniable need to hold the baby, the sense of floating purposelessly adrift when she's not in my embrace. Those are mine. All mine. That longing that stems from the tips of my toes all the way to my entrails, mine. You hardly need a baby slowing you down, knowing as well as she does that she likely has someone in hot pursuit, whom I hardly know, but I register she does, the man or woman who delivered that ochre bruise, I assume. You'll take care of her, she states. Not so much as a question, but a need. I need you to take care of her. I say that I will. My face softens, for the baby's sake, and the words cascade from my mouth like a waterfall. Oh, I will, I promise. I will take such good care of her, like a child who's been blessed with a new kitten. But I can't have you in my home, I say then, my voice tightening, as I walk a fine line between caring for that baby and needing Willow out of my house. Not when you've been stealing from me. And she protests, I didn't, and I interrupt with, just go. I don't want to hear it. The lies and denials, any excuses about needing money for this or that, when it's clear I'm not buying her opening story. She took my father's wedding ring, plain and simple, and sold it at the pawn shop. And now she must go. She doesn't say goodbye to me. She asks again, you will take care of her, of Ruby. But the words come out half-hearted and not genuine. For it's proper etiquette, she must assume, to make sure the baby is in good hands before she goes. But there's a hesitation, nonetheless. A brief hesitation as she eyes the baby, and quite possibly her blue eyes fill with tears. Fake tears, I tell myself. Nothing more. And then she steps toward the baby and runs a hand across her head. She whispers a goodbye before she goes, wiping those artificial tears on the back of a sleeve. I'll treat her as if she were my very own, I avow, closing and locking the door as she leaves. I watch from the bay window to make sure she's gone, moping down the city street in the cold April rain. And then I turn to the baby girl, completely enraptured by her doughy cheeks, her snow-white hair, her toothless mouth that unfolds into a radiant smile, and think, mine. All mine.
Willow. At some point when I wasn't paying attention, I turned 16. And that was when it happened. All of it in about 3 weeks. It was the end of winter and I was feeling antsy for spring, but for whatever reason, the snow kept falling from the ominous gray sky. I was freezing cold each time Matthew and I took the buses around town, and the sweatshirt and gym shoes never seemed to do. The cold winter air blew into each and every bus stop, and since most of my clothes were dresses and jumpers from Joseph, my legs were completely bare. At night, as I slept on that bed with the thin patchwork quilt, with only an oversized t-shirt to keep me warm, I trembled, my body covered in goose pimples, which quadrupled each time Joseph pulled that t-shirt up over my head. I thought of all the ways I'd kill him if I could. Thinking of Mama and I love you likes got replaced with thinking of Joseph and all the ways I'd do him in if I could. Pushing him down the stairs, hitting him over the head with a frying pan, setting the whole Omaha home on fire while he was asleep. But then what would I do? I hate you like arachnophobes hate spiders. I hate you like cats hate dogs. One lifeless winter day, Matthew and I caught the bus and headed to the library. I remember that I was excited, because that day Matthew was going to show me how to use the computers. I'd never used a computer before. We hadn't gone more than a block down the street when Matthew asked if I was cold, and when I told him I was, he sneaked an arm around my back and pulled me close to him. In an instant, it was as if there wasn't another soul on that bus but Matthew and me. like the whole rest of the world had disappeared. Matthew's arm felt warm, strong, secure. I turned my head and peeked up at him, wondering if those chocolate eyes might explain it to me, what just happened. How my insides got all gooey, how my hands turned to slime. Matthew didn't say anything, nor did his eyes. He was looking out the window like he didn't even notice what happened. But inside, I wondered if he felt that change like me after all. We went to the library, and pulling up two chairs to one computer, Matthew showed me a world I'd never known before. He showed me something called the Internet, where I could look up anything I'd ever wanted to know about the planets, or jungle animals, or spiders. He showed me how I could play games. There was music on there, too, on the computer. We slipped on the library's headphones, and Matthew put some music on, kind of loud, but I liked it. I liked the sound of the bass right there in my ear. I thought of Mama, of spinning around the room to Patsy Cline. Going to the library became Matthew's and my regular thing. It was my favorite thing to do. The library was quiet and warm, even though right outside the big glass doors the world was cold and loud. The building was big, 4 stories or more, tucked right there in between all those huge buildings. Sometimes I just liked to ride the elevators up, down, even if we didn't go anywhere at all. We talked a lot there, Matthew and me, and if he told me once, he'd told me 1,000 times that he was going to get me out of that house and away from Joseph. He just had to figure out how is all. By then, I'd started thinking a lot about the world outside of Omaha, and it made life there with Joseph and Miriam even worse. I wanted more than anything to leave, to run as far away as I could. But Matthew said to wait. He was going to figure it out for me. He said not to worry. And so I didn't. But what I really looked forward to there at the library was tucking ourselves into some vacant aisle. Just us. We'd sit on the floor and sprawl our legs out before us and lean up against the towering shelves. We'd skim through the books for random facts and take turns saying them aloud, like, did you know fresh eggs will sink but a rotten egg will float? Or did you know 89% of the human brain is made up of water? Just like we did when we were kids, and Matthew would pass by my room at night. I read books about Audrey Hepburn and Patsy Cline. I looked up that place where Lily now lived, Colorado, and learned more about the flat plains of the 38th state and about the Continental Divide. I learned more about that magnificent mile Mama used to talk about. And I learned about Chicago, the Windy City, city of broad shoulders. Did you know Arthur Rubloff came up with the name Magnificent Mile in 1947? I asked. But Matthew just said to me, what's the Magnificent Mile? And then one day we're sitting there in one of those vacant aisles, when all of a sudden Matthew found my hand tucked in the kangaroo pouch of that orange sweatshirt and pressed it between his. Matthew had held my hand before, on those buses, or when I was scared. But this time it was something different, because this time I could tell Matthew was scared too. His hand was all sweaty-like, and when he grabbed for it I felt my heart grow 3 times inside of me, as if it was going to burst right there from my chest. I didn't know what it was that I was feeling, and I wanted so badly to ask someone, anyone. But most of all I wanted to ask Mama. We pretended for a long time that it wasn't happening, that we weren't holding hands. We just went on searching for random facts in the books with each of our free hands, while the hands that were joined, they were like their own independent beings or something. They were something different. But it didn't stop my heart from beating out of control, my brain unable to grasp any of the words inside the heavy library books. And then all of a sudden Matthew was sitting closer, and I didn't remember it happening. I didn't remember it happening at all, but suddenly his leg was pressed up against mine, and his hip was touching mine, and suddenly we were reading from the same book while the other had been set aside. A book on engineering, whatever in the world that is. I couldn't have made heads or tails of it even if I tried, but I didn't try, because I couldn't think of anything other than my hand pressed in between Matthew's hands, or what it sounded like when he turned his head toward mine and softly said my name. Claire. Matthew said it like a whisper, my name. I could feel the breath emerge from his lips more than I could actually hear my name. I turned to look at him, and he was so close. He was right there, breathing on me, noses all but touching. I didn't know what I was supposed to do, lean in or pull back the other way, but I knew in my heart what I wanted to do, and so I leaned into Matthew and settled my lips upon his lips, lips that were coarse and dry, but also tender and delicious, I thought, as a tongue slipped through those lips and into my mouth, and I felt everything inside me turn to goo. I knew then what was happening to me. I was in love with Matthew. His tongue disappeared almost as quickly as it appeared. His lips withdrew from mine. He pulled away, though he didn't let go of my hand, his eyes darting across the pages of that engineering book until he uttered some stupid facts, nervously, about kilometers and watts, though I had no idea what it meant. I had no idea what any of it meant. I could hardly hear his words. I could hardly stop thinking about his lips, and his tongue, and his hand, the way he tasted, the way he smelled. After that, when Matthew and I went to the library, we weren't so consumed with those books and finding meaningless facts in the pages to share with one another. We'd sneak down whatever vacant aisle we could find, and there, hidden from the world by those tall, tall bookcases, Matthew would press his lips to my lips, would slide his tongue into my mouth. His hands would hold my hands, sometimes. But sometimes they would stray. They would wander away from my hands and to my face, my arms, my chest, between my legs, slipping cold and unsure up under that bright orange sweatshirt and into the sole bra Joseph had given to me.
Chris. I passed through Chicago on the way to Denver for a meeting with a potential client. Face-to-face meetings are big in the world of investment banking. We have a quota for our firm, how many meetings we're to attend each month. 20. That's what our CEO says. 20 face-to-face meetings with clients. Skype won't do. FaceTime doesn't work. Even though I'm 800 miles away, giving presentations to try to entice potential investors to purchase shares of an IPO for another client, I'm to pop into the office for the client meeting, then catch up in Denver with Tom, Henry, Cassidy, and the rest of the crew later in the day. I take the first flight out of LaGuardia at 6 a.m., landing me in Chicago at 7:28 a.m., local time. The meeting is at 9, barely enough time to gather my luggage from baggage claim and catch a cab to the Loop. The client meeting goes exceptionally well. They usually do. Apparently, I have some charm I don't know about, a tender face that makes people want to put their trust in me. It's the reason I'm usually at the forefront of meetings with potential clients. It has nothing to do with an impressive MBA or the years of experience I have tucked beneath my belt. It's all about my smile and the boyish good looks my mother swore would get me in trouble someday. I have an afternoon flight out of O'Hare to the Mile High City. Not enough time to go home, shower, shave, change out of the rancid suit jacket I've worn for days. Though I've managed to short myself on clean socks and underwear, and my lucky tie, for this never-ending trip to hell and back. I put in a call to Heidi, never thinking in a million years that she'd do me this favor, and yet she does. She packs a spare bag of clothes and offers to meet me at an Asian grill for a quick bite. It's only been 40-some hours since I've seen Heidi, and yet there's something different about her, something casual. Something that conflicts with the Heidi I left the other morning, asleep in bed. The overthinking, premeditative Heidi she evolved into somewhere along the path of our marriage. I see it in her step, as she walks briskly down Michigan Avenue, right there where the Mag Mile crosses the Chicago River, at the Michigan Avenue Bridge, completely unruffled by the hubbub of the city. There's a bounce in her step, and she's dressed in a dress, a stone-colored dress that just skims the ankle, surprisingly fitted and chic, not quite what I'm used to seeing on Heidi. She looks amazing. And yet, she's got the damn baby strapped to her in one of those baby slings, and when I ask, "What the heck is that?" she tells me it's called a Moby wrap, as if this is the most normal thing in the whole entire world, her, wearing someone else's baby like luggage. "Where's her mother?" I ask, searching left and right, up and down for the girl. "You didn't leave her at home," I ask. "Alone?" I'm prepared to go into some big diatribe about that girl stealing my big-screen TV, and how she was never, ever to be left unattended in our home. But Heidi smiles kindly and says that she dropped her off at the library, on the way to meet me for lunch. That the girl wanted to check out a few books, Black Beauty, she says, and A Wrinkle in Time, tacking on the classics. Knowing good and well the only thing I read as a kid was the Wall Street Journal. She says that she thought I'd prefer it if Willow didn't join us for lunch, a statement I can't altogether argue with. I just happen to wish she'd left the baby at the library, too. And then Heidi steps forward and kisses me, an impromptu kiss that's not too short and is entirely sweet, the kind of thing my Heidi would hardly ever do, not in public at least. Heidi is a strict opponent of PDA. She's been like this for years, forever, maybe, scowling when she sees some couple kissing on a corner or at the bus stop. Even a quick peck, the have a good day kind of kiss normal couples share all the time. She presses close to me, the napping baby sandwiched in between, running her hands up and down my arms. Her hands are warm to the touch, vulnerable in a way that Heidi rarely is. Her lips press firmly to mine, decisively, and she whispers, "I missed you." And as I draw slowly away, I know those words, those simple, golden words, and the desiring tone of her voice will stay with me all day. We eat lunch. I order crab rangoon, Heidi the chicken pad thai. I tell her about my week. She tells me about hers. I apologize for the gazillionth time for missing her call last night. But unlike the seething voicemail she left me a mere 12 hours ago, this time she shrugs mercifully and says it's okay. What I tell her is that I fell fast asleep, completely bushed from the week. I say that I had a beer or two, maybe three, with dinner, and I didn't hear my phone ring. I don't tell her about drinks at the hotel bar. I don't tell her about Cassidy proofreading the offering memorandum in my hotel room, alone. That wouldn't be very sensible. In fact, it'd be downright dumb. I don't mention Cassidy's lissom frame or the profile of her breasts in the rust-colored dress, though still they're on my mind, like some greedy little kid wishing for candy. "What did you need to tell me?" I ask. And she laughs wholeheartedly and says, "I can't even remember anymore," as the waiter refills our glasses of water. Heidi's smile is sympathetic, the epitome of a submissive wife. Her hair is clean, no more spaghetti hair, and there's some sort of musky, perfumey scent coming from her, something I hardly recognize anymore in my wife. I didn't even know Heidi still owned perfume. Or maybe it's the shampoo. Her words come out solicitous as she says, "You must be so tired, Chris. You're always on the go." And I admit I am tired. And then she tells me about the baby, how the antibiotic has been helping her get better. She's feeling better and sleeping better, which, in turn, means Heidi's sleeping. I can see that her eyes look rested. She's found the time to take a shower and put makeup on. Not much. A dab of blush, maybe some lip gloss. But enough that there is color to her skin. She's not a frightening white. Maybe that was all she needed, I think. A good night's sleep. "When I get home," I say, "we're going to need to talk about all this. The whole Willow situation." And though I'm expecting some sort of backlash, casual Heidi to disappear and be replaced with uptight Heidi once again, it doesn't come. She simply says,
"Of course. Yes, let's talk. When you get back from Denver."
"But," she adds, massaging my free hand, the one that isn't stuffing deep-fried dumplings into my mouth like I haven't eaten for a week, and then lacing her fingers through mine and offering a squeeze,
"I have a feeling everything is going to be just fine. You'll see. It'll all work out."
And I find myself, somehow, convinced that it will be fine. We say our goodbyes and exchange bags, me taking the clean socks and undies, my lucky tie, Heidi carrying away my dirty laundry like some dutiful 1950s housewife. I watch as she heads off down the street, veering in and out of pedestrian traffic, heading in the opposite direction of the library.